Okay, we got one question. Sister gave me a question. Here's the question. It says, in Genesis 1, God has put us in charge of His creation. Correct? Absolutely. So can we do with creation whatever we want? Is it moral to do in vitro fertilization where the parents choose how their kids look like to avoid deformation or abnormalities or even physical enhancements for cosmetic surgery, etc.? This is a good question. We did an entire conference last fall on this, on ethics and Christianity. I did a class on bioethics in which I talk about that. So you go to my website, you can find some of that material. And the answer is that there may not be easy answers to all these questions. Now, my voice, sorry about that. Now, it is true that God has given us charge over these things, yes? But it says in 1 Corinthians 4, verse 2, now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. So God has entrusted us with this physical world, and we as human beings must be faithful to that trust. So one application, nothing to do with her question, is then we ought to be taking care of the environment. Christians may not devote their whole life to environmentalism, but Christians should be environmentally aware and should be taking the lead, at least in some level, on that. But what about these things which are not natural in a sense? Well, I could give you the long version. The short version of this is God has given us the ability to create technologies. And I think these technologies, as a rule, are something we should embrace and use. So we're not going to be like the Pennsylvania Dutch. We're not going to get in a car or take a plane. But I would say anything that we could do without technology but is made easier with technology is something we probably ought to embrace. All right? So, for example, any technology that helps us to live happier lives, more fulfilled lives, that extends our natural life, it's hard to think of why that would be immoral. But things which are more questionable are things that would enhance our body in a way that's unnatural. For example, we're a direct connection between a computer and our brain and making us more intelligent than we other would have been, or giving us superhuman physical capabilities. Here where we're doing things that would not be natural, they're more questionable. Now, in vitro fertilization, that's a tough one. I don't have an absolute answer to that. But I would say this, that basically it allows infertile couples to have children. And, you know, it seems like that's a good thing. The problem that's raised is if you make a number of fertilized embryos and then you kill some of them. All right, so, I don't know what to say about that. Because the bottom line is fertilized embryos often die. All right? But a lot of disciples would take the position to create an embryo that's fertilized and then to discard it or kill it. That would be an ethical problem for them, and I totally get that. So my advice is, if you're going to do in vitro fertilization, is there's two ways to do it. One where they implant every embryo that they make, all right? Or ones where they make lots of them and they just implant a few. I would say if you feel your conscience doesn't allow you to do that, then I'd say just don't do in vitro fertilization at all. But understand that, you know, there's a freedom amongst ourselves that, you know, people get to decide. But I'd suggest if you are going to do in vitro fertilization, don't have 30 embryos and then just discard them. That seems to be a little bit problematic. Another thing is, it's just a matter of time before we're going to be able to do pre-implantation genetic variations. All right? And you could use that to prevent your child from having a genetic defect. I don't know. I have a hard time seeing that as a sin. You know what I'm saying? On the other hand, you could use it to make your child have blue eyes or run faster to kind of enhance beyond what's natural. So these are things that we as individual disciples are going to have to work out over time. And I don't have definite answers for these questions. It's a very good question. It's something we should think about. And that's my answer. Okay? So now we're going to do a lesson on the reliability, inspiration, and inerrancy of the Bible. Now, remember I said some of our Christian evidence, some of our Christian apologetics is awesome stuff for sharing your faith. Those last two lessons, whether they're awesome or not, you decide, but the stuff is awesome. All right? Man, you need to use that stuff to share your faith. Seriously. I mean, hopefully you found yourself kind of going, wow. Right? Because it's like, wow. Now, this lesson is more like to defend your faith against the attacks of those who try to cut it down. So this stuff in this lesson, you might possibly use it in an evangelistic thing, but it seems less likely. So these are more like, hey, people say this and they say that. And here's the thing is, when you have a doubt, don't shove it under the rug. Don't do that. Because when you stuff things under the rug, they have a bad way of coming out at the wrong time, you know? When you're struggling spiritually, you're discouraged, you're down, nothing's happening, you're being tempted, suddenly, boop, they pop up. So I'd say deal with the stuff when you're doing well spiritually. My suggestion is to kind of keep a running list of questions that you're working on. If you can't find an answer, then send it to me at my website. I answer all questions. I have well over 2,000 questions that have been answered there. It's probably already answered, but if not, send it to me, I'll answer it. Okay? But don't just shove these things under the rug. Okay, good. I already talked about this. How to handle apologetic questions. Here's your outline. We're just going to do it now. Okay, good. Now, a little comment. How do I answer questions? This is kind of a general comment about dealing with questions of skeptics. All right, don't overreach. What I mean by that is don't oversell the evidence. Don't ever use evidence that's maybe yes, maybe no. There are kinds of like scriptures that you could use as a messianic prophecy. For example, you know the prophecy about the virgin being with child? Remember that one? I don't use that one when I study. The reason is the Hebrew word actually means young woman. Okay, now, the Greek translation was virgin. So I'm convinced that this is a prophecy that a virgin will be miraculously with child and will produce a son, and we're going to call him Emmanuel, and it's Jesus. But I purposely don't put that one into the study because, to be honest with you, there is a counter argument that this word does not mean virgin. All right? So be careful. Don't do what they do. Don't do what your opponents do, which is throw out, like, remember that guy Robert Price with the Jesus myth thing? He throws out 27,000 things, hoping you won't notice that every single one of them is really weak, hoping just by bombarding you with lots and lots of stuff, you won't notice that fact, and you'll kind of get manipulated into its conclusion. So I say don't overreach. Don't use evidence that's not really solid evidence that you could honestly say before the harshest skeptic, they'd have to say, you know, I have to admit, at the very least, although I don't agree with your conclusion, you know, there is something there. don't paint yourself into a corner. Don't make claims that you aren't going to have to later say, well, yeah, well, actually, to be honest, you know, yeah, it is, maybe that's, maybe not what that scripture is saying. Don't ever use the scripture to say something it doesn't say. I know a couple times I've been studying another version, the NIV, and I'm reading it, and I realize an application I made using the NIV for years, I realize in the other version it doesn't really say it that way. Now what I'm tempted to do is, well, just ignore that and keep using it, you know? But no, we need to discipline ourselves. Just stop using that example. The thing is, if you're right, you don't need to do that kind of stuff. You don't need to play games with people. Right? Don't undersell it. Don't apologize for the evidence. Leave some ammunition. Alright? So when you do your messianic prophecy study, or when you do your evidence for the existence of God, leave some ammunition in your gun. I don't know if I like that metaphor of a gun, but, you know, because here's the deal. You say this, and they throw this back at you, and you say, hey, yeah, and this, 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 and this. All right, you see what I'm saying? Just a strategy. Don't use all your stuff. Because they're going to come back at you, and you say, yeah, and then there's this, and there's this, and then there's this. Okay? Be confident. You have one slight advantage over those people. They're wrong. You're having a debate with a Muslim, and one thing you have going for you, even if you're confused, even if you can't defend your point, it just so happens that you're right and they're wrong. And there's just something about being right. You know what I'm saying? I'm serious. All right. Anyway. All right, so people say, you hear this all the time, you can't trust the Bible, there's all these errors, there's all these changes. What about the Apocrypha? What about the Gospel of Thomas? All right, so that's the stuff we're going to deal with now. So I'm going to talk about the reliability of the Greek and Hebrew text, as well as questions about the canonization. Okay, got it? All right, so I'm going to give you, these are some of the things people say. The Gospels were written in the 2nd or 3rd century. They're fabrications. They're designed to make Jesus into something that he even never said he was. There are many extra Gospels. There was this big fight over the years. And, you know, the Orthodox, they won out, so their Gospels are in there. Although those were rejected, not because they weren't true. Neither is true any more than the other. And, you know, basically the winners win, and they get to decide what it is, and that's how it works. I hear this stuff all the time. Maybe you don't hear this stuff. I hear this kind of stuff on my website all the time. And everybody knows that Constantine totally changed the New Testament. Everybody knows that. All right? Bart Ehrman says, the New Testament was a very fluid document well into the 5th century. All right? These are the kinds of things you hear. If you haven't heard them, you will eventually. Spend time on campus, you will. All right, now some of you are thinking, oh man, is that true? Oh man, whoa. All right, don't worry. Don't worry. All right. The Gospel of Judas. Maybe you heard about that one. You know, National Geographic had a new gospel. It's just like all the other gospels. Some of these alternative versions, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Philip, may have circulated more widely than the 4 familiar gospels. First of all, that is not true. Second of all, even if it were true, and it's not, that the gospel is circulated more widely than the gospel of Thomas was circulated more widely than the gospel of Matthew, which it wasn't. But even if it were true, numbers does not make truth, all right? Even if that were true, the gospel of Thomas cannot possibly be an inspired gospel for a reason we'll talk about. A long buried side of Christianity. See, the Catholic Church has been putting lies on you for years. It's a big conspiracy. that the Catholic Church put together the New Testament. Well, actually, that's true. Because the early church was Catholic, which means universal. So that's one of those tricky questions. Got to know about that vocabulary. Okay, good. Now, I don't have time to get into the whole Gospel of Judas thing, but I'll tell you a few things. First of all, it's not a gospel. In other words, it doesn't include the birth of Jesus. It doesn't include the death of Jesus. And it doesn't include the resurrection of Jesus. And it doesn't have any of the miracles of Jesus. So, by definition, it's not one of the gospels. You can call it what you want. You can call it pizza if you want. It's not pizza. It's not a gospel. Okay? And the fact is, it did not exist before about 170 AD. And here's another thing is, now it is true there were these Gnostics. And the Gnostics did produce these other writings, which were never gospels, none of them were. But even the Gnostics never claimed that these were the original writings. Even they didn't claim that. The Gnostics had their own lists of Bible books, right? And their lists were the same as our lists. Even they didn't claim this. Now, they had their other stuff. They said this is the deeper hidden truth. But even they did not say that the Gospel of Judas was one of the Gospels. Even they didn't say that. Anyway, I don't want to get into that stuff, all this crazy stuff. To say that this is like the four Gospels is, man, it's crazy. All right, here's another one. This, remember the Da Vinci Code? The young people, they don't remember the Da Vinci Code, right? You campus, you don't. But us old people remember the Da Vinci Code. Almost everything our fathers taught about Christ is false. This is utter damn rot, as they say. Can I say that? The word damn is in the Bible, right? All right, I can say that. Right? There's a lot of words in the Bible, right? Hell's in the Bible, right? All right, here's another one. Constantine turned Jesus into a deity who existed beyond the scope of the human world, an entity whose power was unchallenged. Basically saying, Constantine made Jesus into God. By the way, this is total, utter nonsense. That no person, nobody who understands the information we're going to give you could possibly even conceive of this as even being a remote possibility. This is such nonsense. It's almost like a joke, except there's some people who actually believe this junk. But this stuff is out there, and there's people who say this with great confidence, as if you Christians have all been deceived and hoodwinked. I'm telling you, the shoe is on the other foot here. All right, there's these other quotes from that book. More than 80 Gospels were considered for inclusion in the New Testament. Absolute lie. There are exactly four Gospels that were ever considered for, and none other, and there's no evidence to the contrary. There is not the slightest evidence anywhere that any other than the four Gospels were ever considered. So this is just flat out a lie. All right. So let's talk about the reliability of the text. Talk about manuscripts, church father quotes. These are evidence for the reliability of the New Testament. Okay, got it? We have manuscripts. All right. There's parchment, which is basically leather. There's papyrus, which is paper. There's these different materials. There's scrolls. There's codex. A codex was a long strip of vellum that they folded to look like a book. Scrolls. These are words that, if you don't know the meanings of these things, you know, come back, look at these definitions, look at it later, because I don't have time to really get into all this sort of stuff. Papyrus, vellum, parchment, uncials. All right, all the early Greek texts were uncials. All of the early Greek texts were only capital letters with no spaces. Capital letter, capital letter, capital letter, capital letter, until the end of the letter. All right, and there were minuscules. These were the kind, see, capital letter, then small. This is later manuscripts. Only after about the 7th century did you have this kind of writing. So if you ever heard this word, uncial, that means the oldest kind of manuscripts, all right? It's technical words. So this is an uncial. This is a minuscule. If you saw these two, any scholar would know immediately, much later, much earlier. Okay? Now imagine trying to read that. It's pretty hard to read, even if you knew Greek, all right? Even if you knew the alphabet. Because there's no spaces between the words. There's no punctuation. The result of this is that copying it exactly is kind of hard. All right? And so the fact is that errors came into the copies. Okay, got it? Now let me throw it out there. Okay? The original autograph writings are fully inspired, and I'm going to give you reasons to accept this conclusion. Now, be careful when you quote me on this. In fact, don't you dare quote me on this. I'm going to say something, and then I'm going to explain it, and don't you dare quote me on this. This is not inspired. All right, here's what I mean. This is in English. Okay, got it? Now, it's an excellent translation. And luckily, we have several translations. Plus, we have access to the inspired original. Plus, we have dictionaries, and we have lexicons, and we have commentaries. We have people give their entire life to this stuff. I believe we have so much access to so many resources that we can literally understand the original Greek probably better even than the people who received the original letter. And I'm not exaggerating. However, technically, this is not inspired. There is no evidence that the translations are inspired. Because if they were, they'd be exactly the same. By the way, I'm going to say something even crazier. Hold on to your seat here. We have almost none of the words of Jesus in the Bible. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. That's one of the words of Jesus. But Jesus didn't speak Greek. So even the words of Jesus in the Gospels are an apostles or other writers' translation of what he said. Now, don't tell this to a brand new Christian. It's true. It's true. All right, but you have to kind of, you know, all right, everybody, let's just take a deep breath. Now, here's the thing. It is inspired. And it is, if carefully defined, inerrant. Right? So, when John says, this is what Jesus said, but he's saying it to his best ability of Greek, John's interpretation of Greek, Jesus' Aramaic sayings are inspired. Okay? We do not have the exact words that Jesus spoke. Think about it. When you read Abraham, you know, talking to his son Isaac, is that an exact transcript of the exact words spoken on that occasion? How could it be? But it's inspired. It reflects what actually happened, and it's inspired. Now, so you have to kind of broaden it. Again, that's why I wouldn't have a baby Christian first week out. I wouldn't have him even, you know, I'd prepare them. But I'm just telling you things that are true. I mean, everything I'm saying is true. You can't deny it. It's true. All right? So, for example, you might have two different versions of the Sermon on the Mount. They're not exactly the same. Well, maybe what it is Jesus preached many times. In fact, he might have preached that basic sermon a number of times. It's possible that Matthew collected together a number of sermons and put that together. Now, I believe there was an actual sermon where Jesus got up on the mountain. You know why I believe that? Because the Bible says it, and it's true. All right, so anyway, I got off the subject. So the bottom line is, the act of translating is not inspired, and the act of copying is not inspired. So there are errors in our Greek and Hebrew texts. Okay? Now, I'm going to show you in the next few minutes why that should not hurt your faith in any way whatsoever. Okay? So here's a vellum codex. This is not paper, by the way. This is leather. Imagine the monetary value of this leather document. I mean, in today's money, it would be worth probably $100,000 for one Bible. I mean, it's incredible. This is papyrus, cheap. Now, the manuscript evidence we have for the New Testament is amazing. All right? Does anybody question the writings of Julius Caesar? Nobody does. Does anybody question the writings of Tacitus or Homer or Cicero or Aristotle? Nobody does. Look how many manuscripts we have of Aristotle's writings. 5. And they're partial. Nobody questions the reliability of those documents. 5 manuscripts. The youngest manuscript we have from Aristotle is 1,450 years after the original. Nobody questions the reliability of Aristotle. And there's many more examples, but you get the idea, right? Okay. Now, what about the Greek New Testament? We have 8,000 Hebrew manuscripts instead of 5. And the oldest manuscript comes, instead of from 1,450 years after the original, comes from roughly 50 years after the original. So what we have is an overwhelming amount of evidence. In fact, there may be more evidence for the New Testament than all other ancient writings by all people at all times ever combined. So you see why I'm saying we have some reason to kind of think that, you know, just possibly maybe the Greek New Testament that we have access to is pretty reliable? There's a reason for that. And what's interesting is these Bible haters, who I believe are serving Satan, yes, sir, try to create the impression that they're honest in their evaluation of the evidence. And yet, they don't question Caesar or Sophocles ever. It's obviously. And yet, they say you can't rely on the Old or New Testament. You know, come on. Who do they think they're fooling? Here's the Rylands Papyrus. It's in the Rylands Museum. It's in Manchester. I went there. It's pretty awesome. It's like the Bible. I mean, this is a kid in a candy shop. So awesome. Okay? And it's from roughly 125 AD. So this is maybe a copy of the original, or maybe a copy of the original. Something like that. Okay? Now, that's a pretty small chunk. And it's on the front and on the back. So you go there, you can see the front and the back. It's in a glass case. It's really, it's so awesome. If you're ever in Manchester, go to Manchester United Stadium. That's like, you know, Mecca. But then go to the Rylands Museum. Okay, the Sackler Library, this is a piece of John for 150. The Magdalene Manuscripts, 175. That's in the Magdalene Library at Oxford, or is it Cambridge? One or the other. All right, Roland could tell you. Chester Beatty Papyrus. Go to the Chester Beatty Museum. It's in Dublin. The largest collection of really early New Testament Greek manuscripts. It's a room full of these things from the 2nd century and the 3rd century. All right, that's 2 Corinthians. the Bodmer Papyrus, 200 AD. A recent discovery, and what it is, it's funerary masks, paper mache. So when they killed people, they would use paper mache to make like their covering. And in one of these, they found what appears to be tiny little chunks, like, you know, the paper shredder kind of thing, which appear to be from the book of Mark, dated to 80 plus or minus 20 AD. All right, you got that? Now, this evidence is somewhat tentative. Remember I said, don't overreach your evidence. I would not like put this out there too strongly. All right, they're still working on this, but anyway. And then we have entire New Testaments in Greek from between 300 and 350 AD. Codex Sinaiticus. I was in the British Museum. I took this picture, and then the guard came over and said, "Hey, what are you doing?" "Oh, sorry." Sorry. Codex Bezae from about 400. These are some of the manuscripts we have. All right, we have hundreds of these. We have dozens from the 2nd century and many dozens from the 3rd century. And we have entire New Testaments from the 4th century, like 325 to 350 AD. So the kind of manuscript evidence we have is really quite remarkable. Remember that list of the oldest manuscript for these others? They're all from 1,000 years afterwards, 1,500 years afterwards. Okay, great. I'm not going to get into that. Not only that, but we have translations. The New Testament was translated from Greek into Coptic in the 2nd century. That's the language in Egypt. And it's like a snapshot. It's a snapshot. And even if you have an older manuscript of the Coptic, it's like a snapshot of the New Testament in the 2nd century. And we have many of those. Old Syriac, Old Latin. These are many, many other languages that can give us additional information if there's some questions. Then there's the Church Father quotes. Clement, writing in roughly 96 or 95 AD, quotes from 10 of the New Testament books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, Romans. And this tells me two things. It tells me by 95 AD, these books have already exist, obviously, and they're already considered inspired. If you read Clement, he quotes extensively. He was like a walking source of quotes from the Old Testament, and then peppered randomly through those, treated exactly the same as his Old Testament quotes are his New Testament quotes. So what this tells me is already by the end of the first century, we have an emerging canon of New Testament books. Whereas the critics will tell you the New Testament canon formed in the 5th century. Lie. Lie. Okay? Ignatius quoted all those books. Okay, 108 AD. Now it's been stated, and I'm no expert, it's been stated, if you take all the manuscripts from the 2nd and 3rd century, you can reproduce almost the entire New Testament from those things, just kind of cut and paste. That's a lot of evidence. Now remember, the claim is that Constantine changed the New Testament in the 4th century. Well, in order to do that, he would have had to burn thousands and thousands of manuscripts as if the church would have let him do that. Why would he even want to do that? You know? This idea that the Bible got changed in order to create a Jesus that wasn't in the original, or that, you know, these Gospels were written in the 2nd century. If they're written in the 2nd century, how come Clement is quoting them in the 1st century? You hear all kinds of stuff out there, and this stuff is either grossly distorted or simply not true. Polycarp quotes from Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, blah, blah, blah. Irenaeus quotes every New Testament book, etc., etc., etc. Not once did any of these people ever quote from the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Mary. Actually, Irenaeus did, in order to show that these were bogus. He also quotes from the Gospel of Judas, by the way, around 180 AD, showing how bogus it is, which shows us that the Gospel of Judas was written by 180 AD. All right. So the bottom line is, the evidence for the reliability of our manuscripts is astounding. Now, however, there are copying errors that happened. You hear things said like, there are 200,000 manuscript errors in the New Testament. I believe it. But then again, there's 8,000 manuscripts. So if you divide 2,000 by 8,000, all right, that means like 15 mistakes per manuscript. Oh, okay. Suddenly, you know, you realize they're throwing numbers out there just to create this false impression. Okay? But the bottom line is, it's hard to not make mistakes when you're copying. And mistakes were occasionally made. Now, let's say you skip an entire line. Well, that mistake would be obvious, because the fact is, what we have is literally thousands of manuscripts. So if one person misspelled it in one copy, we have copies of all the other manuscripts. Well, that's easy to correct. All right? And besides, spelling errors, it's kind of obvious, right? Slips of the pen, lines repeated, scribes trying to smoother improve the text. Now, this did occasionally happen. Occasionally, there's things that Jesus said which are kind of like, wow, that's kind of tough. So good meaning people, because sometimes, say, Luke would say something different from Matthew. So what the scribes would do is they would make them be the same, trying to help us out. They're not helping anybody out. All right? But the thing is, because we have so many thousands of manuscripts, and also some common sense rules. For example, if you have two manuscripts of Matthew, one agrees with Luke, the other one is different, which one are you going to use? Think about it. You've got the thing that in Luke you're confident of. You have two versions of Matthew with one slight difference. One is the same as Luke, the other one's different. Which one's probably the original? The answer is the one that is different. Because every once in a while, a scribe would try to improve the text, which of course was never an improvement. Also, there's these things called interpolations. Now, did you ever write anything in the margin of your Bible? Okay. Do you ever write something between the lines in the Bible? Now, the difference is, it's printed text and it's your pen. So that's not hard to figure out. But sometimes, something would be written there and the next person would include it. It's called an interpolation. So, for example, Acts chapter 8, if you believe in your heart, you may, that is an interpolation. So you go to Acts 8, it says on the bottom, but you got the footnotes. The bottom line is, that thing, if you believe in your heart, you may, that is not in any of the manuscripts before, I think it's like the 10th century. So it's not in any of the ancient manuscripts, all right? That means it wasn't in the original. So people say, well, blah, blah, blah. Right, okay. Here's the deal. It wasn't in the original. So there you go. By the way, what if he did say, if you believe in your heart, you may? Does that change the meaning of the Bible? No. So these supposed changes are almost without exception, but not totally without exception, almost without exception, something that doesn't change the meaning anyway. This idea that we do not have a reliable New Testament text is very far from the truth. Okay? All right. I'm going to skip all these. This is a bunch of extra stuff. All right. So there's John 7:53 through 8:11. You got a little thing. It turns out the earliest manuscripts, Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus, Vaticanus, those are the complete New Testaments from the 4th century. They don't have it. Actually, one of them does. The other two don't. Two of them, though, have, like, one of them has it in another place. So, was John 7, 53 through 8, 11 in the original Bible? The answer is, I'm not sure. Now, all scholars agree that this tradition goes back to the oral tradition. In other words, this was part of the oral tradition which was used to create the New Testament books. So was that thing in the original John in that place? The answer is probably not. It was almost certainly in one of the Gospels somewhere. But even if it wasn't, it was part of the accepted oral tradition that the apostles had been teaching everywhere they went. The bottom line is, 99.9%, I'm very confident that this is exactly what Jesus said. Now, are you going to go lose your salvation and leave the church over this thing? Now, Acts 8:37, 1 John 5:7, and John 5:4, these are all interpolations. In other words, there is no question about it. These weren't in the original. End of story. In fact, the only significant chunk of the New Testament about which there's any significant concern, really, is Mark 16:19-20. Really, seriously, it's the only significant in-doubt passage in the entire New Testament. All right, so was it in the original? The answer is, the oldest manuscripts do not include it. So I would say more likely than not, Mark 16:9-20 was not part of what Mark wrote. The only thing in the entire New Testament in which you might have to say, because there's differences of opinion. There is no difference of opinion on these. All right? There are differences of opinion on these. I believe the ones who like totally support this, I think they might do it more because they wish it was in the original. You know, those who believe and are baptized will be saved. Those who are not condemned. It'd be kind of nice. But here's the deal. There's nothing in that passage that changes any belief in the New Testament. All right? Got it? All right. Now, please write down questions if you have them. All right? There's some extra stuff here. All right, here's an example. You are my beloved son, and you I am well pleased. That's what it says in Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, and Alexandrinus. However, Codex Bezae says, you are beloved, my beloved son, today I have begotten you. All right, that's a textual variant. Okay, got it? And then what you can do is you can compare that to Mark 1:11. All right. And you can, between all that information, you can make a reasonable decision and conclude that, actually, this may very well be the original. Okay? All right. Even Bart Ehrman, the hyper-ultra-super critic who tries to get you to not believe anything, even he admits that the corruption of the Scripture, as he calls it, means that scribes change everything in the text or even most things. All right. Even he says the issues involved in the corruption usually entail nuances of interpretation. These are important nuances, arguably, but most of the New Testament can be reconstructed by scholars with reasonable certainty. Even the hypercritic, enemy of God, enemy of Christianity, even he says these are tiny, tiny little things that are insignificant. And even he says, there is as much certainty as we can construct of any book of the ancient world. All right, good. So bottom line is this. We have the New Testament in Greek in its original form to roughly 99.9%. And the 0.1% that are in doubt involve no significant question or issue of Christian doctrine or teaching. Okay? That's what the evidence says. What about the canonization? All right? How do we know we have the right books? Were there any other books that were considered? Were there any other inspired books that didn't make the cut? Let's talk about that. Now, here's my bottom line analysis of the information as I see it. All right? A collection of Paul's letters, perhaps not including the pastoral epistles, existed and was circulating in 90 AD. In other words, 90 AD, still in the first century, there's still people who knew Jesus. John was still alive, for example, the Apostle John was still alive. In 90 AD, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, these books were circulating as a group in the New Testament, amongst the churches. Also, the four Gospels were being circulated as the four Gospels together and recognized as apostolic by 100 AD, perhaps even by as early as 90 AD. So, now, what I don't want to say is the entire New Testament canon, as we currently have it, was accepted by 100 AD, because if I said that, I would be lying. And I don't want to lie, okay? There was still some debate in the first half of the second century over certain books. Got it? There was. So as late as 150 AD, some people would have included Revelation, some would not have. So there still was a fluid but developing list of canonical books being read in the church by AD 150. Okay? Now, by Irenaeus, AD 180, he calls the Gospels the four pillars of the church. There is no evidence of any other Gospels ever. We have the Muratorian fragment, which is virtually exactly the same list. It doesn't include Matthew, Mark, and Luke because it's broken. All right? Got it? So my conclusion, based on the evidence, feel free to ask questions, is by the year AD 200, the New Testament that we now know it to be was the list of canonically accepted and authoritative books throughout the entire New Testament church. Was there any remaining debate about any books at 200 AD? I mean, there were some people that wanted to include a couple of extra books. I'll mention those. And there were a couple of books that some people were like, yeah, I mean, we all agree. But they admitted there's some people that, you know, maybe had a little thing to say. Okay? Origen listed the same exact number in 220 AD. All right, great. Now, it turns out there were other books that were circulated, specifically these books, Shepherd of Hermas, Epistle of Barnabas, and Didache. All three of these were written by sometime in the early second century. And the early church fathers said these are, in quotes, profitable for reading in the church. And the fact is, the Codex Sinaiticus has one of these. I can't remember which one. So the Codex Sinaiticus has the same 27 books. And at the end of that, it also has one of these. I can't remember which one. So is that person saying it's part of the canon? No, it's just it was also there. All right? And so I invite you to read the Didache. And one of the ways to understand what an inspired book is, read one of these other books. Read the Gospel of Judas. Read the Epistle of Barnabas. The Epistle of Barnabas says things about the Jews. You kind of go, ouch, whoa. Yeah. Read the Old Testament Apocrypha. Read Tobit or Judith. Then you go, wow. Some people thought this was inspired. One of the best ways to know what an inspired book looks like is to read one of these other books, and then you find yourself going, oh, all right, never mind. Seriously. Read the Gospel of Thomas that has Jesus saying Mary had to become a man because no woman could enter the kingdom of heaven. You know? The Gospel of Thomas has Jesus turning clay figurines into birds and flying up. Like, seriously? You know what I'm saying? All right. So it is true, there were three or four other books that one person over here, one person over there, attached to the New Testament and it said suitable for reading. But the consensus of the New Testament church is they were not apostolic, and therefore they were not included. All right? Now, I don't know if I have time for this stuff. Here we go. The New Testament canon was selected by a consensus of the church. So who chose the books in the New Testament? Well, historically, the answer is the early church. Which, who? The entire church. Based on what? Based on apostolic, authority. In other words, the books that they considered to be apostolic, which doesn't necessarily mean written by an apostle. Luke was not an apostle. But the books that all the churches agreed the apostles had said to the church are inspired. Okay? The evidence is conclusive that the Greek New Testament we have is virtually identical to the original writings of the inspired writers. Okay? Now, I want to do the same thing I just did with the New Testament. I want to do it in the Old Testament, and I want to do it in 10 minutes. Okay? So, we're going to go really fast. Because I've got to cover this, and I have to finish it today. All right, great. So, what about the Old Testament? Here we have a copy of the Psalms. All right, from the Dead Sea Scrolls. I believe this one is somewhere around 125 BC. I don't know the exact date. Now, the reliability of the Old Testament, there's this thing called the Masoretic Text. The Masoretic Text is called the Masoretic Text because the Masoretes made it. These were Jewish scholars in the 5th, 6th, and 7th century who carefully controlled the copying of the Hebrew, and they also compared all the different Hebrew manuscripts and came to the conclusion, because there were slight differences. So today, we create a Greek text, which is the best Greek text we have based on these thousands of manuscripts. That's what these people did. So, all the Hebrew manuscripts after about 800 AD are virtually exactly identical. Because the Jews created an accepted Hebrew text called the Masoretic. Is that good or bad? They did this awesome scholarship to create the perfect, ideal Hebrew text. It was good for them, but bad for us. Because the reason is, they got rid of all the earlier manuscripts. And the Jews basically said, when a manuscript reaches a certain age, you bury it or burn it. So, therefore, we need other evidence such as the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Septuagint. And we have so many other pieces of evidence. Okay, now we have the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation. So what we have is a snapshot. Now, we have a snapshot of the Old Testament in 200 BC, the Septuagint offers great evidence to support, because the Septuagint is from 200 BC, whereas the Masoretic text is from 1,000 years later. So there's some questions about this particular one word in the Hebrew text. We can compare the Septuagint translation into the Greek, the Masoretic of 1,000 years later, and we can settle certain unresolved things. Because remember, scribes made mistakes. Okay? We also have other languages. We have many, many, many quotes from the Jewish writers. All right, now, here are the copies of the Masoretic text. Cairo Codex, 895. Aleppo Codex, 920. Leningrad Codex, 1008. So we have lots and lots of evidence for the Hebrew text around 900 AD, all Masoretic. Well, the problem is, these are 1,500 years after the original. Could some copying errors have happened over the span of 1,500 years? Yeah. Could somebody well-meaning have added stuff, significant stuff, and taken it out? Honest truth is, maybe they could have. But then we had the Dead Sea Scrolls. By the way, these Masoretes, they were insane. Take your craziest perfectionist you ever knew. And they're nothing compared to the Masoretes as they made their copies. The Masoretes knew the number of times every single letter occurred in the Old Testament. They could find the middle verse of the Old Testament. They could find the little letter of the Old Testament. And when they copied, if you counted the number of letters Aleph, and if the number of letters Aleph was not the right number, throw it out. These guys were insane in their attempts to produce an exact copy. Before starting, you have to wear the right clothing. You keep track of the middle letter of the Pentateuch, the middle verse of the Hebrew Bible, the middle word of the Old Bible, the middle word of each book, the middle letter and verse of each book. And they counted the number of times each, etc., etc., etc. These guys were crazy. And that explains why it is that when you see the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're virtually identical to the Masoretic text. Are they identical? No, they're not. Did changes happen? Yes, they did. All right, but is the Hebrew text reliable overall? Absolutely. All right, here we go. So, here's when it's written. Here's the Masoretic text. The Dead Sea Scrolls spans roughly two-thirds. When it's written, Masoretic text, the Dead Sea Scrolls span two-thirds of that time. And yet, the Dead Sea Scroll, Isaiah, and the Masoretic text, Isaiah, is almost identical. All right? So if we know from a 1,000 years, is it crazy or unreasonable to think maybe the other 500 years they did a pretty good job? Yes, they did. In Isaiah 8, 13 changes. In the entire book of Isaiah, over a course of 1,000 years, 13 minor changes between the Dead Sea version and the Masoretic text. Got it? There you go. We have so many other sources. I don't have time. We need to take our break. But the bottom line is there are numbers. Let me be honest with you. Our Hebrew New Testament is not as reliable as our Greek New Testament. I said our Greek New Testament is 99.9% accurate. All right? Our Hebrew Old Testament is not 99.9% accurate. It's not. I don't know. It's hard to say. I can't give you a number, maybe 98%. There's a few reasons for this. Now, which one is the correct copy? American or American? American. How'd you know that? Because American is not even a word. Right? But copying of numbers is not that way. Which is the correct one? I don't know. How would you know? So the bottom line is, there are some mistakes. In fact, people tell you, well, this one says 5,000, this one says 5,100. The Bible's not inspired. No, a copier made a mistake. So don't bet your life on whether it's 500 or 510. And does it matter? Does the nature of God matter on whether it's 500 or 510? Also names. Is it Nebuchadnezzar or Nebuchadrezzar? Does it really matter? But honestly, there are more copying errors in the Old Testament. Okay? Because it was copied over a longer period of time. Also, because copying Hebrew is more difficult. See, Hebrews, the Jews used, you know, like Roman numerals, X and L, they used Hebrew letters, but the Hebrew letters are really similar. So it makes it pretty hard. All right, bottom line is 98% instead of 99.9%, something like that. Okay, got it? But again, the evidence says no significant change that would relate to the nature of our faith based on that. We talk about the canon. We know less about the canonization of the Old Testament than we do with the New Testament. God relied on the early church to choose the New Testament canon. The evidence from the quality of those books is it was a good idea. God used the Old Testament, the Jews, to choose the Old Testament canon. The evidence to me is they did a good job. One of the ways I know that is because we have the Old Testament Apocrypha. All right, so here's my conclusion with the Old Testament. The canon of the Old Testament was set by consensus of the Jews. The entire canon existed by 300 BC and probably much earlier. Okay? And our Hebrew and Aramaic texts are very reliable, but not as precise as the Greek. Okay? Then you can look at the Apocrypha. Feel free. Read First Esdras. Read Judith and Tobit. All right, read the additions to Esther. Read 2 Maccabees, where he says, you know, I did the best I could, but it's not great, but I'm sorry because I'm not so great, you know. Do you see anything like that in the Old Testament books? You can read Ecclesiasticus, which says, God atones for sin through almsgiving. Oh, I don't know about that one. All right, so these things speak for themselves. Just read them. I'm telling you, if you read the Apocrypha, it won't make you less confident of the Old Testament. Trust me, it'll make you more confident. All right, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, blah, 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 lots of extra stuff. What about the other Gospels, Gospel of Thomas? What about the inspiration of other books? All right, I don't have time for that. I'll say this. Muslims will not discuss their text. All right? If you mention the other texts, they will kill you. So how reliable is their text? They won't even discuss other texts. They pretend there are none. We Christians publish them all. And we openly discuss them. And the Muslims say, the Old Testament, the Bible is corrupt. That's what they say. And yet, they won't even discuss the Quran. We have this thing called textual criticism, right? You don't do text. There are no Quran textual critics. They're all dead. Only non-Muslims could do it, but even they might be killed. So when Muslims tell you the Bible is corrupt, they have no evidence for this. They'll tell you the New Testament got changed. You just come back to this stuff. All right, so that's that short version. All right, we're going to take about a 6-minute break, and then we're going to take some very quick questions and answers. Okay? I'm skipping about 50 slides here. Okay, great.
You need water?
I've got plenty of water. I wish I'd ended about 5 minutes earlier, but
no problem.
We're more or less on schedule. You see, I went too long.
Do you still have a lot to